We have three readings today that come from David Eagleman's book, Some, 40 Tales from the Afterlives. Eagleman is a neuroscientist by day and a fiction writer by night. The first tale is entitled Some. In the afterlife, you relive all of your experiences, but this time with the events shuffled in a new order. All the moments that share a quality are grouped together. You spend 2 months driving the street in front of your house, 7 months having sex. You sleep for 30 years without opening your eyes. For 5 months straight, you flip through magazines while sitting on the toilet. You take all your pain at once, all 27 intense hours of it. Bones break, cars crash, skin is cut, babies are born. Once you make it through, though, it's agony-free for the rest of your afterlife. But that doesn't mean that it'll always be pleasant. You spend 6 days clipping your nails, 15 months waiting in line, 2 years of boredom. Your eyes hurt and you itch because you can't take a shower until it's your time to take your marathon 200-day shower. 2 weeks wondering about what happens when you die. 6 weeks waiting at a green light. 2 days lying. 15 months doing laundry. 3 days calculating restaurant tips. 67 days of heartbreak. 9 days pretending you know what's being talked about. 4 minutes wondering what your life would be like if you reshuffled the order of events. In this part of the afterlife, you imagine something analogous to your earthly life, and this is blissful. A life where episodes are split into tiny pieces, where moments do not endure, where one experiences the joys of life jumping from one event to the next, like a child hopping from spot to spot on the burning sand.
What happens after we die? For as long as human beings have been consciously aware, we have wrestled with this question. Here are some of the, billion different answers we've come up with. I come up with 11 right here. The good and righteous people live blissfully in eternity up in heaven, while the sinners are condemned to eternal nothingness or worse, to the fiery pits of hell. No, the second tale suggested. It's sinners who are condemned to eternal life, and the good people get to rest eternally. Everybody gets to go to heaven, no matter who you are, what you did, or what you believe. The cycle of life goes on forever and forever, and the quality of our next incarnation depends on the karma that we accrue in this life. The cycle of life does not go on forever, necessarily. There is a way out. The way out is the realization of nirvana. Nothing much happens other than our biological cells return to the earth and our impact on loved ones lingers for a while until we are finally completely forgotten. We return to God, to the great energy at the heart of the universe. We linger on, possibly forever, in spirit forms on the earth. Sometimes this is a good thing. Sometimes it's a curse. The elected will be beamed up to heaven in the rapture, leaving the bad people behind in an earth that degenerates. In heaven, you get to hang out on the clouds listening to harp music. No, that's too boring. Heaven is the thing you like to do best on earth. Maybe it's harp music. Maybe it's reggae. Maybe it's listening to the waves of the ocean pounding in. Heaven is an individual thing. You get to do what you like to do. A few of the possibilities. Now, for much of our lives, this question of what happens when we die is somewhat abstract, somewhat distant. But at points in our life, it becomes very, very immediate. It's smack in front of our faces as we deal directly with our own mortality or the mortality of a loved one or a family or a friend. And without a doubt, today, there are people in this room who have this question right in front of their face. And there are people in this room today for whom this is a much more theoretical and abstract question. Wherever we are in thinking about this question, there's one thing that I think is true. None of us really knows the answer. No one knows. It's the one thing about the afterlife I think I know for sure. No one knows. Even people who have near-death experiences, well, it could be something else going on there, and they don't always seem to have the same understanding, so I'm not sure that they even know. We just don't know. We can't know. Part of the deal of being human is we wonder about this, but we cannot know. But boy, wouldn't it be nice to know? So this is the great mystery, the biggest question of all. It's as if at birth we're given this blank canvas on which we can paint our answer to this question of what happens after we die. And so we spend a lifetime tinkering on and off with this painting. All of the possibilities I just mentioned, and who knows how many others, those get painted onto our canvases. But we don't know. We don't know if we did the right picture until maybe that moment of death when we cross over into whatever's next. Sometimes I imagine that when we cross over, we all have the same word as we look at our canvas, what we painted, we thought the afterlife would be, and what it really is. And that one word is, oh. 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 A few. I can see St. Peter, or whoever is at the gate, being very amused with how we say that one word. If we can't know for sure what happens, why bother worrying about it? Isn't it just an enormous waste of spiritual time and energy, wondering what happens when we die? Well, I believe that how we answer that question, how we paint the canvas of what we think happens, is actually really, really important. That it has a huge influence on how we live our lives in the here and the now of this world. Even though it's just a guess, it provides a frame for how we see life with a capital L and our own life, small l. How we picture the afterlife is actually intensely about this life. Orthodox Christians who are appalled by the universalist idea that everyone's saved, they understood this. Because they objected to it in terms of what it means on this life. They said if you don't have the carrot of heaven and the stick of hell, you're not going to do good things here. The universalists answered with a this world focus too. They said, no, if you think everyone's saved, that God is all loving, then you understand that our job as human beings is to try to embody that love to everybody. That's the source of our belief in the inherent dignity and worth of all people. It's a this-worldly value, but it goes back to this otherworldly idea of what happens when we die in universalism. The picture we paint of life, is of the afterlife, is important. Another example is Billy Graham. In 1950, the great evangelist Billy Graham painted a picture of heaven that was kind of like the second reading, that heaven is this great suburb, that, in his words, we are going to sit around a fireplace and have parties and be waited on by the angels, and we'll drive down the golden streets in a yellow Cadillac convertible. Fast forward 56 years, and Billy Graham had a completely different idea of the afterlife. Now, that suburb afterlife that he envisioned, only the few, only those saved would get to go there. But 56 years later, he envisioned the afterlife as union with a loving God and everybody gets to go. I would guess he behaved differently based on those two very different visions of the afterlife. Look at the three tales we heard. Each of those had a lot to say about this life. In the first tale, we come to an appreciation of the variety of human life as we jump from one experience to another. Now, sometimes we experience this as a curse, but it sure beats the alternative of having to do 5 months of this and 200 days of a shower. And life is so much sweeter with its variety. The second tale flips the traditional view of heaven. In the second tale, the sinners go to heaven while the good people rot in their graves. Doesn't sound like a good thing to be a good person, does it? But there's something to the brevity of life, the lack of immortality, that makes life so rich and sweet. The infinity of time could crush us if we were immortal. Much of the sweetness of life comes from the fact that life is so darn fleeting. Imagine living in a beautiful Monet painting for eternity. You know, you're by those lily ponds or those beautiful haystacks gleaming in the sunlight. And after a couple thousand years of it, I think you'd begin to lose track of the beauty and the joy and the serenity that we feel as we look at that painting for a minute or 10 minutes or an hour in the museum. That whole experience is bookended by the idea that it's brief, that there will inevitably be a leave-taking as we leave looking at that beautiful work of art. That knowledge that the experience will soon end, I think, deepens the experience. I think that's true with life. And then the last tale lifts up the sweetness of this little insignificant life that each of us have. Here are these cosmic creatures holding up the universe, and they envy us and our inconsequential lives. Living here is a vacation for them. Maybe the story says the meaninglessness, at least the relative meaninglessness of our small lives in the grand scale of things, maybe that meaninglessness is a gift. This afterlife view reframes the understanding of this life. So, it matters what you believe about the afterlife. Even though it's ultimately nothing more than a guess, it matters. So spend some time. Spend some energy on how you paint your canvas, your picture of the afterlife. Go back to it every now and then. You may want to tweak some things. You may want to just start over. It's okay. Today I'm not telling you what you ought to paint in your view of the afterlife. What I'm saying is work on it. Work on it. It'll help you live today, here.